You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and today I will be speaking with that other gentleman who doesn't look like me. That other gentleman on the screen is Professor, do I call you Professor Marion Orr, Dr. Marion Orr, or can I call you Marion?
Marion is just fine.
Marion's good. Well, so Marion, my new friend Marion is a professor at Brown University, and the occasion for this conversation is I think it's about a month away, right? The publication of you can pre-order right now, but the book that is sitting behind him, that poster behind him. And it is called, and in front of him, and then magically appearing on the screen right now. You won't see it until afterwards, but the book is called House of Diggs, The Rise and Fall of America's Most Consequential Black Congressman, Charles C. Diggs, Jr. So Marion, thank you so much. I'm sorry for our unexpected technical difficulties that put us behind on the clock, but I really appreciate you being
here. Thank you for inviting me. We got through that technical problem, so I'm very excited about being here and talking to you and your audience.
Yeah, and is there something to be said? Why don't you describe a little brief bit of your career and how you ended up at Brown? And you don't have to go through the whole thing because I know it's long. You're a very accomplished fellow, what should we know about you that I haven't said already?
Yeah, well, I'm on my 25th year here at Brown. I'm a political science professor. I study cities, race, and politics. I'm from Savannah, Georgia, born and raised in Savannah, Georgia. I learned about Congressman Diggs, the person who I cover in this book, while I was an undergrad student at Savannah State College down in Savannah, Georgia, my hometown. I learned more about the congressman when I went to graduate school at the University of Maryland to study political science. That's a bit about me. I've been doing this work on Diggs for about 10 years now.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. He is no longer alive, but he is a very consequential fellow in the civil rights movement and the political scene. And yet, well, I don't know, you probably find this as well, is that a lot of people have no idea who he was, never heard his name before. It strikes me as he wasn't out there looking for attention. He was getting things done. And is that a fair assessment there?
I think it is fair. You know, one of the issues in Black American history is we tend to focus on a relatively few number of key Black leaders during the Civil Rights Movement. Dr. King, Malcolm X, Rosa Parks. And so many of our key leaders are often overlooked and not covered. Diggs is a classic example of this. And my biography of Diggs, I hope, is like a corrective biography, letting people know that this man, who, as you said, was a significant civil rights leader and a member of Congress, and he accomplished a tremendous amount during the 25 years he served in Congress from 1955 to 1980. He's someone that, for some reason, and I think I know why, we tend to overlook him, but he, as I lay out in the book, was tremendously consequential, a remarkable American leader.
Yeah, that's, you know, I suspect when we spoke about this, when we had our first conversation, he's, a lot of people are probably glad that this man has finally got a book about him.
Yes, he really deserves recognition, David. You know, I uncovered, for example, that Diggs, for example, was the only federal official at the trial of the two white men who murdered Emmett Till.
Right.
He was there in 1955. He had just come to Congress in January of 55. And in the summer of 1955, he decided he would go down to Mississippi and observe that trial. And it was an important thing for him because it symbolized what kind of Congress member he wanted to be. And he wanted to be a Congress member, not only for Detroit, which he represented, but for all of Black America, especially for Black Americans in the South, who at the time did not have much political rights. And let me just be clear, you know, during the time when he was active, again, from 1955 to 1980, he got some attention. I mean, he was a very close colleague and friend to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He, as I think we talked before, he was the founder of the Congressional Black Caucus. David, he was a leader in the effort to bring local democracy to Washington, D.C., and he was the leading advocate in Congress for bringing down the racist regime in South Africa. So during his career, he got some attention.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was often overshadowed, for example, by Adam Clayton Powell. Mm-hmm. Many people who know Congress during this period of the civil rights era might recognize Adam Clayton Powell. He was the Congress member from Harlem, from New York, and he was very flamboyant, handsome, publicity seeker, captured a lot of attention in the media. So Diggs, I argue, was somewhat overshadowed by this dominant character, Representative Adam Clayton Powell.
Right. Yeah, I remember Adam Clayton Powell from growing up.
Yeah. And the other thing, and let me add just real quickly, David, you realize that my book is subtitled The Rise and Fall.
Correct. Yeah.
And I also believe that Diggs' fall from grace at the end of his career also diminished the attention that he would have received or should have received. I would add also, David, and Congressman Diggs said this when he was going through his trial and conviction, the payroll violations that Diggs was convicted of, again, he was convicted of it, was something that many other members of Congress had been doing also, but they weren't prosecuted the way Congressman Diggs was. So Diggs, in fact, argued that he was a political prisoner at the time because he thought his violation did not violate any rules in Congress. Or he would argue that he did things that were very similar to other members of Congress.
Yeah. Well, let's bracket that for just a bit, and we'll get back there, I promise. But is there a time? I mean, was there a reason why you took up this? You know, I mean, Diggs has been around and gone for a while, and he just, you know, he was in the dustbin of memories of, you know, his name's in the book, and if you knew the name, you could search for it, and you know, he's there, but. But no one, as far as I could tell, I don't know if there's been another biography of Diggs. And so why'd this come about?
Yeah. Well, you're right. This is the first biography of the Congressman.
First biography
of Diggs. David, I learned about Diggs many, many years ago. I mean, I was an undergrad student when I learned about his contributions. As I said earlier, when I went to graduate school, I learned still more about Diggs. I discovered that he left his personal papers archived at Howard University in Washington, D.C. And when I learned and discovered the papers, some 750 boxes of papers.
Wow.
Wow. Here is a huge, what we call in political science, a data set. It's data that we could use and analyze. Knowing Dick's contribution and recognizing his tragic fall,
mm-hmm.
I felt that this would be an interesting character and story to convey to the American people.
And had you ever written, because it sounds like the book, and again, it's not out yet, but it sounds like the book is written in a sort of narrative. It's a biography and you're written in a narrative style. Have you ever written that before? I mean, you're an academic guy.
totally new for me in doing this. I'm trained as a political scientist. My focus over the years have largely been writing about cities and urban politics. But one of my passions have been political biography. So in my sort of spare time, I spend a lot of time reading biographies, good biographies. And I like biography. And I think I learned a lot over the years simply by reading other people's work. And I simply felt that I could do it. And I also understood, I took the approach that I was trying to reach a broad audience, something I have not tried to do in my previous books. And that calls for a different approach, a different writing style, a narrative style. And so I had really fun, trying to do this in a new and different kind of way.
And
what I learned about biographers, they talk a lot about scenes, you know, and they're like, you know, this is a great cinematic scene. And so throughout the book, man, I have these wonderful scenes that I was able to sort of tease out and write out and try to relate to the reader. And that was fun. A different kind of writing, no apothecis or positivist testing that we do in political science, just good narrative writing, trying to connect to the reader and to convey to the reader how important this Congress member was.
And so let's visit for a second, and if you will, you know a lot about this. You have 750 boxes. So he was consequential. In what ways? Like what was so important about what he did?
Yeah. I believe it's the sort of tangible legacy that you could point to with Charles Diggs Jr. What I mean by that, for example, we mentioned when we talked earlier that Diggs was the founder of the Congressional Black Caucus, which is today caucus of some 60 members and perhaps the most powerful caucus in the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
It was Diggs' idea in 1969. Okay. He brought together the other five members who were black in the House. And he said, we need to work together. And they agreed and they called their group the Democrat Select Committee. And that committee, the DSC, that Diggs became the spokesman and leader for, worked for a couple years on issues around civil rights and black freedom. In 1971, David, the number of blacks grew to 13 members. And it was at that point where the 13 members came together and decided that it was time to changed the name from the DSC to the Congressional Black Caucus. And again, they selected Diggs to be the first chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Mm-hmm.
The caucus today, as I said, is very, very influential, very powerful, especially within the Democratic Party in the House. So in terms of tangible legacies, you can point to the CBC, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Diggs was also the leading proponent against the apartheid regime in South Africa. The American anti-apartheid movement, David, started in the late 50s and early 60s, literally in Congressman Day's congressional office. In 1969, he became the chair of this subcommittee on Africa. And he used that perch as subcommittee chair to bring to the American people what was happening in South Africa. Most people, black, whites, in the 50s and 60s, had no idea of apartheid.
No.
But Diggs was talking about apartheid in the late 50s and early 60s, trying to push our government to change its policy toward South Africa. Okay, so in just terms of tangible things you can point to, Diggs simply stands out. Let me add another one real quickly.
Please.
I have a chapter on it in the book. Washington, D.C. today has what's called home rule, whereby citizens, voters in the district can elect their mayor, city council members, and school board members. Very few people know that prior to 1973, the United States president appointed the mayor of Washington, D.C.
Right.
There was no local democracy at all in the district for 100 years. In 1973, Diggs became the principal legislator and sponsor of the bill that became the Washington, D.C. Home Rule Act, which allowed voters in D.C. to elect their local officials. Now, we could talk about this later, but it was a compromise that Diggs had to make in regards to that. But again, the point I'm making here, David, is when you just go down the list of his accomplishments, mm-hmm. you can see and feel the impact of this man's 25 years in Congress.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Did he also figure big in the, you know, in the Voters Rights Act?
Well, he played a role. He was a very, very close associate of Dr. King. Much of the challenge for the Voting Rights Act was on the Senate side, where Democrats and supporters had to get through the filibuster. But the House was sort of, for the most part, passed the bill. It was what's going to happen in the Senate.
Mm.
Nevertheless, Diggs' role in the 1965 Voting Rights Act is this. When Dr. King went to Selma, leading into Bloody Sunday, Dr. King wanted to highlight the challenge that blacks face in Mississippi and Alabama across the South around voting rights. And so he goes to Selma, Dr. King does, and he gets arrested. And he gets arrested and he's jailed. He refuses to post bond because he felt being arrested, he would raise the conscience of America about voting rights.
Right.
One thing he did is he called up his friend, Charlie Diggs, and he asked Diggs to come to Selma and to bring with him his colleagues from the House. And he did. He brought along 15 other members. And they came and they went and they had hearings and looked out what was going on in Selma and helped elevate, if you will,
yeah.
what was happening there because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. He didn't, right? His father was a state legislator, but he wasn't a heavily political family, or was it? I mean, I think that they were in the mortuary business. Yeah.
This is correct. Diggs was born in Detroit in 1922. His parents had migrated there during the Great Migration. His father and mother formed the House of Diggs Funeral Home, hence the title of our book, The House of Diggs. And the House of Diggs Funeral Home dominated Black Detroit's funeral market. In the 50s and 60s, David, if you were a black man or woman and you died in Detroit, you could bet that the House of Diggs would be the funeral home that would have your body. So the family became somewhat prosperous because of the funeral home. And his father, Charles Diggs Sr., leveraged the success of the funeral home into electoral politics, winning a seat in the Michigan State Senate in 1936 as the first Black Democrat in the state Senate. And Diggs, I believe, the congressman that is, I think he followed his father and picked up on his father's whole notion of public service. And he too would run for the state Senate, winning his father's old seat, and then in 1954, run for Congress and win.
His father never was in Congress, right? Never went.
No, his father never was in Congress. He was Charles Diggs Sr. was a prominent Detroit and Michigan state figure. Charlie Diggs Jr. brought the Diggs name nationally and internationally.
Yeah, yeah. Was he? There was the South Africa endeavor. Was he sort of widespread in involved in international affairs and politics or no?
Well, he was on the Foreign Affairs Committee. He was the first Black American to be appointed to the House Foreign Affairs Committee in 1959. Okay. Diggs had a special interest in Africa. It's an interest that really goes back to his grandfather. His paternal grandfather was from Mississippi, but he ended up being a Baptist missionary to Africa, to Liberia. So Diggs and the Diggs family have had a very long interest in Africa. In 1958, Diggs was a part of the official delegation, U.S. delegation, to the Freedom Celebration of Ghana. And he was invited there as a part of the delegation. And once he went to Africa, his first trip to Africa, he became committed to trying to bring freedom to Africa, especially Southern Africa. So it was one of his major policy areas. In fact, David, by the time Diggs left Congress in 1980, his colleagues referred to him as Mr. Africa because he had such extensive experience and policy knowledge about the continent.
And was he... This kind of sounds like a juvenile question, but is there, what was he, did his colleagues think of him as a rabble rouser or, you know, sort of like a pain, this guy's a pain in the ass, or was he highly respected and well regarded and, you know, in the mix?
Yeah.
Could you tell that from the materials you bumped?
Yes. Diggs was highly respected, highly regarded among his colleagues in the Congress. He had a reputation of being a hard worker. In addition, David, he got along well with people. I interviewed several colleagues who served with him, and everybody described him as a likable person who got along with people, Republicans, Democrats, whites, Blacks, Southerners, Northerners, okay? But at the same time, he was never, if you will, one of the boys who, you know, was part of the leadership, because he would push, if you're talking about the 1950s and 1960s, where Black freedom was up front. And so while he got along with people and people liked him, he also pushed hard and forcefully for Black freedom here in this country, in America, and in Southern Africa. He was a remarkable guy that people really liked. He was, at his core, David, a coalition builder.
Yes.
He was able to build these, you know, coalitions with Republicans, with Southern Democrats, Northern Democrats to try to get things done in Congress. So, and was, I think it was part because his personality, his he was very deferential in many instances. He got along well with folk, and people could sit down and work with him. Well, he sort of knew how far to push, you know, in order to keep people in line. You know, he was not going to be pushed around at all, but at the same time, he did not want to, you know, tear down a bridges that he would need to get things done.
Right.
Diggs recognized very clearly, David, that if we were going to change America in terms of civil rights, that you would have to do it through the Democratic Party. Because by the 1950s, the Democratic Party had become the party of social reform.
Right.
And the other thing he understood, that if he were going to change civil rights policy, you had to get it through Congress. And if you're going to get things done through Congress, it requires compromise. Many instances, it requires building coalitions and working with others. And Diggs understood this. And here's something that real quickly. I argue in the book that Diggs' approach to politics in Congress is what I call the politics of strategic moderation. By that, what I mean is that Diggs understood in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that Black Americans, who were like 12% of the population, if they were going to move forward on civil rights, that they really had to have broad support. And so he was one of these Black American leaders who felt very strongly, for example, that forming a Black party, for example, in the 50s and 60s would not be the way to get things done. There were some Black nationalists in the 1950s and 1960s who argued that Black Americans should have their own political party.
Right.
Or should not be linked with any of the two major parties. Diggs disagreed with that. Okay. He felt very strongly that the Democratic Party was the vehicle to change public policy in the Congress.
And, you know, you're just pointing at something that just popped into my mind. So did he, within the stuff that you looked at, did you get a sense there that, did he get a lot of criticism for being too moderate, not radical enough? You know, those were the days of, maybe they're always the days, but there were some strong voices pushing for isolation, essentially, you know, racial isolation, et cetera. Yeah. And did he get critique for that?
Yeah, there were some, let's say, younger members of the Congressional Black Caucus who felt that Diggs was not aggressive enough. But when you talk to the members, like I did, who served with him during this period, let's take, for example, Washington, D.C. and Home Rule as an example.
Perfect.
David, Diggs understood that Home Rule was insufficient, that D.C. would still have a colonial sort of presence, if you will, under what's known as Home Rule. But Diggs also understood that in the 1970s, you were not able to get a bill through Congress that would grant the district statehood. Those folk who were pushing, who were, you know, more radical, argued for statehood. There, the D.C. would have two senators and someone in the House who could vote. Now, Diggs was for statehood, but at the same time, he recognized that he did not have the votes to get home rule through the Congress.
Right.
And people like Ronald Dellums, who was the Black Congress member from Berkeley, California, radical left-leaning Black Congress member from Berkeley. You know, Berkeley is a left-leaning community. And when I interviewed Ron Dellums, he told me, he said, I trust Diggs on home rule because I knew Diggs would push as far as he felt he could. Moreover, Dellums told me that Diggs supported Dellums' effort around a home rule bill. A statehood bill.
Yeah.
Recognizing that statehood was not going to go anywhere, but nevertheless, he did not prevent or stop Dellums from pushing the issue of statehood. So I guess what I'm trying to say to you is that, yes, he received some criticism for not being, quote, radical enough, but Diggs always understood how far he could push the curve. I'll just add that Diggs also understood the seniority system, how it worked in Congress. He knew as he and others got reelected consistently that they would build up seniority and become important, you know, chairs of committees and subcommittees. He understood this, and he wanted to use that system to do what he could to help Black Americans and folk in Africa.
Right, right. Well, let's get to the hard part. So you know, as is so often the case, you know, it's a strong resume, and but he's not a perfect man.
Yeah.
Right? And so he did this thing which may be true. Maybe it may be something that a lot of people were doing. Who knows? So could you explain some of what led to, you know, the rise and fall? What led to the fall?
Yes. Diggs in 1978 was convicted of 29 counts of mail fraud, and it linked with his illegal payroll kickback scheme that he put in place. The funeral home, the House of Diggs funeral home, which was processed for many years, fell on hard time. And eventually it collapsed. Diggs, for whatever reason, and I was not able to uncover all of it, had a difficult time managing his personal finances. He would seemingly always overspend, David, even as a young man. For example, he worked for the funeral home, worked with his parents, and got a salary. And early on, he would spend his salary and come to his father and ask for more money. And his dad would say, come on, what are you doing? No, I give you a salary. You have to live within that. All he did was go to his mom would give him the money. But throughout his adult life, David, this guy seemingly had a difficult time for whatever reason managing his personal finances. So despite the fact that he had a salary from the funeral home business and a salary from Congress, he was always seemingly underwater. And he relied on the funeral home to get extra cash. Now, the funeral home would collapse because Diggs was the only child. And once he went to Congress, there was really no one to run the business. And he and his father hired people to run the House of Diggs. Many of those people stole from from the Diggs. They stole all money. They were taking all kinds of things from them. So to make a long story short, the funeral home collapsed because Diggs was in Washington. No one really watching it.
Yeah, nobody's looking at the cookie jar.
Yeah. And so listen, once the funeral home collapsed, he had no access to this extra cash that he was getting. And so he decided one day that he would get his secretary. He gave his secretary a raise, David. a substantial raise, and she agreed to this. A woman agreed to do this, and the money that she got from the raise came to Diggs to pay his personal bills and some of his congressional expenses. It's kind of odd, okay? And this went on for a couple of years before the secretary decided she wanted out and she stopped doing it. Mm-hmm. She resigned. And so what happened is the person who replaced that woman as chief of staff, I'll tell you his name was Randall Robinson. Diggs hired Randall Robinson, a Harvard-trained lawyer, to be his chief of staff and to help Diggs on Africa issues in particular. Randall Robinson, the Harvard-trained lawyer who was Diggs' chief of staff, David, went into Diggs' files, discovered what Diggs had been doing because he had stopped doing it because a woman had already resigned. And from the FBI files that I obtained, I discovered that it was Mr. Randall Robinson, Diggs' chief of staff, who one day in March of 1977 called the Justice Department and reported Diggs' payroll violation. He asked the government, that is, Robinson did, not to reveal his identity. So to this day, no one really knows about Robinson's involvement in Diggs' downfall.
Can I ask you how? So it's somewhere in the files that information is there,
yeah.
And the files were not public. So it really was a secret.
Yes, I got the files through the Freedom of Information Act, David. Mr. Robinson refused to talk to me.
Mm.
He died in March of 2023. And I tried to get him to talk to me, but he refused. In fact, he was the only person who I contacted who worked with Diggs who refused to participate in this.
Yeah, got it.
And after I got the FBI files, I discovered, okay, this is why he didn't want to talk, apparently. Let me add, he did send me a statement. He would not answer my questions. He sent me a statement that I could use in the book. It's not in the book because he simply says he enjoyed working for Diggs and Diggs was a great man. He doesn't say anything about his time working. So Diggs is investigated. He has a trial in Washington, D.C., David.
They determined that there's enough there. They indict, they arrest him, they indict him.
Yeah.
He goes on trial and loses.
Yes.
Did you have a sense from the papers that, you know, they had it out for him? Or like somebody picks up the phone and says, this is going on. It may be going on in a lot of places, but it's going on here, and somebody, you know, dropped a dime on him and called and said, hey, is there anything to suggest, you know, that they were gleeful that they caught this guy, that they finally got Diggs, they got dirt on Diggs, or no?
No, I did not get that sense.
Got it.
Diggs' FBI file starts in 1954 when he's elected, and it ends in 1980 when he resigns and goes to prison. And one of the things that I observe in reading the file is that Diggs is viewed, you know, by Hoover and his agents as being someone who's not, you know, a radical and not anyone that we should be really concerned about.
Got it.
The civil rights era.
That's interesting.
Let me say this, Dave. This was a shock. I mean, his colleagues could not believe this. I interviewed them, And Lou Stokes, who represented Cleveland, Ohio in the House for many years, said to me that he just could not believe Diggs would do something illegal. He had this reputation. He was highly respected. Many people thought he had lots of money because of the funeral home.
Yeah, well, he did have more money. But
they really thought he was a wealthy guy.
Yeah.
And people were shocked when this indictment came down. Diggs maintained his innocence. Once he was convicted, he appealed the conviction up to the Supreme Court and was denied in the appeals. And let me just add finally on this downfall piece, we can talk more about it, but Diggs was convicted in October of 1978, and his voters reelected him in November of 1978.
Oh, well.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the rules of the House at the time allowed a convicted Congress member who had been reelected by his voters
to serve,
to return to Congress and to participate in Congress. And Diggs made it very clear that he planned to do just that, that the rules of the House did not require him to resign, and he was going to appeal his conviction. Okay? And then Newt Gingrich got involved. I have a chapter in my book entitled Diggs Meets Newt. In 1978, when Diggs was reelected after being convicted, Newt Gingrich was elected for the first time in Georgia. And David, before Newt Gingrich left Atlanta, before he took the oath of office, he began to attack Charlie Diggs, saying that he, that is Newt Gingrich, could not serve in Congress with a convicted felon.
Oh, wow.
And he arrives in Congress in January of 1979, and Diggs is his biggest target. And this young Congress member, the freshman Congress member,
yeah,
Republican, would lead this public effort to expel Diggs. He actually put a resolution in to expel the congressman for his conviction. Eventually, what happened is that Diggs was censured by the House, largely because of Newt Gingrich's public efforts. He was censured by the House, and then eventually the Supreme Court refused to hear his appeal. And in June of 1980, Diggs resigned from Congress after 25 years. And in July of 1980, he goes to prison, where he would spend 7 months in a minimum security prison in Montgomery, Alabama.
And he didn't pass away until what year?
The congressman died in August of 1998. So he left Congress in 1980, and he lived until 1998.
And what was his life like after that? Was he still active in whatever ways he could be?
Diggs returned from prison, and he moved to Prince George's County, Maryland, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C., and he would become active in county-level politics in Prince George's County.
Okay.
Yeah, he actually became a member of the NAACP of Prince George's County, and he ran for the state legislature in Maryland. He lost, but he ran. Diggs would begin to see himself largely as a senior statesman, speaking to groups, giving advice behind the scene to Congress members, especially Black members. He never got back involved in his mortician profession, for example.
Right.
Yeah, he lived some of a quiet yeah. life after Congress.
Yeah. And did he have children that survived him? And
yes.
are they still around? And
yes,
are they have they read the book? Well, or at least have they read a draft?
Yes, I was very, very fortunate, David, to have the support of the family. And they left me alone to do my own work, but they talked to me, they provided me. Oh my gosh, David. I have in my book letters that Charlie Diggs wrote to his mom and dad when he was in college.
Wow.
His family kept all of these documents, and they shared them with me. He had six children, and I interviewed all of them. One child is now deceased, so he has five children that are now alive. His first wife, Juanita Diggs, who's in her 90s, still alive, and she helped me a lot. She had great memory. The family is excited about this. David, Diggs' children, I believe, understood how consequential their father was. I think they knew that he was significant and consequential. Let me just add, I'm convinced that Congressman Diggs understood the import of his contributions also. And I think this is why he kept so much of his papers. This is why I think he donated them to Howard University. I think he was thinking someone would at some point come along and tell his life story. In fact, he says this to his children at some point. Diggs is sort of getting rid of all of his papers and stuff, and he's giving it to his six kids. You know, he sends this to this person or send that to that person. And he would say in letters, which I have, you know, maybe this material can be used someday to tell our family story. Oh,
yeah. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. He kept a lot of material, and that's why the book is so rich with insight and material about this man and his life, because he was a prolific writer of memos and letters to presidents. I not only have the Diggs papers at Howard, but David, I went to six presidential libraries and gathered documents about the congressman from Eisenhower to Jimmy Carter.
Wow.
He was really a remarkable American, and I'm just so thrilled and happy that I was able to have opportunity to write this book.
Well,
has received some high powered endorsements. I'm very excited about.
That's great.
And so, yeah, and I tried to write this in a way, and the reviewers thought so, that it's readable and accessible to a broad audience, and that gets my juices running, because
that's
an academic, that's really what you want, you know.
Yeah, I completely get it. Yeah, so much of this stuff is, no offense, but so much of the academic, you know, I was in academia for years as a graduate student, right? And you know, it's dry. It was interesting to me, but it was so dry, and it was so, you know, ultimately how many people read it, because it really wasn't written for people.
You're right. No, I think you're right, and that's something I think we all have to overcome. And writing a book like this biography really, really gave me a chance to bring my expertise and knowledge to the life of this remarkable American who has sadly been forgotten.
Yeah. Well, no longer. So, is there anything left that you would want to say about the book?
If you want to learn more about the book, you should go to my website, marionorr.com. And
I'll put that up on the screen.
I think the book is going to provide a correction to much of what we know or think we know about the civil rights movement, about Black leadership, and about Blacks in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm very excited about it.
That's great. That's great. Well, Marion Orr, Dr. Marion Orr, Professor Marion Orr, and Marion, thank you so much for being willing to have this conversation. And
well, I thank you for the time. I enjoyed this. You asked some really great questions. I like it a lot. Thank you.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.